Join Sam and Will as they bring the Bible's stories to life through historical evidence and try not to feel out of place in a car garage, all while bringing you Under the Hood.
Welcome to Under the Hood. I'm your host, Will. I'm here alongside Sam. Sam, what are we talking about today?
Today we're going to be focusing on a school of philosophy that's known as Stoicism. It's been like kind of a resurgence of popularity lately. Everybody is reading books about it, checking out Marcus Aurelius's book on this. And one of the things I want to do is to look at what it is, what it teaches. Is Christianity compatible with it? And where is Christianity not compatible with it? And just to look at this, because we live in a day and an age right now where I would say we're probably one of the generations of all time in human history the least capable of handling suffering.
Yeah.
And Stoicism comes with a philosophy that talks about how to deal with a hard life, how to deal with suffering, what kind of perspective you should have to make it through this life, which is very hard. And so for modern people, I think we live in a day and an age where we've seen, you know, anxiety going through the roof and all of these things where the world isn't getting softer, even technological advances are happening, and yet there's still suffering and misery and depression and everything else. And I think people are desperate going, how in the world do we deal with this? And here lately, they're checking out Stoicism again.
Yeah, I was actually recently introduced to it, but Ryan Holiday is a modern author who's kind of has a resurgence of Stoicism. So for me, Marcus Aurelius didn't matter, but this guy's now bringing forth, he's writing books about like ego is the enemy, those kinds of things, saying like, okay, maybe Stoicism is the way. So in modern days, especially for men, it's very popular right now.
Mm-hmm. And I was telling somebody just before we started recording, like if I have neighbors that aren't going to believe in God, like I think I would want them to be Stoics,
yeah,
because it really does give an ethic that says you should be virtuous regardless of your circumstances for the sake of virtue. Now, I don't understand how they get there and the motivations, like it's still a little off to me, and I'm not an expert on Stoicism, but I kind of want to walk through and just trace from a 10,000-foot perspective what it is that Stoicism is, how it came about, what it teaches, and then compare and contrast it with Christianity.
Okay, so where do we start? Where's the beginning of Stoicism?
So the beginning of Stoicism, you have to go all the way back to 300 BC, a little bit after that, with a guy named Zeno who founds it. It's kind of a weird name. Sounds like Zeno. An alien ruler or something, Zeno. But he comes along and he says, you know what? You should live according to nature. The world has some designs to it, obviously. It rewards some behaviors. It punishes other behaviors. So live according to nature, and he says virtue is the highest good. And one of the things that he says is you should distinguish between what you can control and then do something about it and then let go of everything that you can't control.
Which like wise.
It is wise. Like if you can't control it, why sit and stew about it, which you know every human being on planet Earth is really good at that. So Stoicism says, like, if you can't control it, don't care about it. Stop caring about it. Put it out of your mind. Only deal with what's in front of you that impacts you. Do the virtuous thing and try to conform yourself to the way the world operates, right? Change your soul to fit the way the world moves.
Yeah, it takes a lot of mental discipline from what I know about Stoicism because it is a lot like, okay, you have to train yourself. Like, you can't control this, so get rid of it. Stop thinking about it. Every single day you should be working more and more towards what only my thoughts matter for what I can control and what I can't.
That's right. That's perfectly said. So then the next guy that comes along is going to be a couple of hundred years later. His name is Epictetus. He's like known as a teacher of, you know, inner freedom. And one of his lines that I think is a really good kind of like purpose statement for what he teaches. He says, it's not what happens to you, but how you react to it that matters.
Hmm.
So again, really good advice, and this is coming from somebody who had been a slave for his early part of his life, who had become a freeman, and he's basically teaching like, okay, I could live in the past, I could be focused on all the things that have happened to me and how I have a right to do X, Y, Z, and he's like, it's not what happened to me that matters, it's how I react to it, and so I'm going to, you know, harness my mind and all of my thoughts to make today the very best day possible, regardless of what's happened to me in the past. And I'm not going to sit and stew about the future. So one of the other things about Stoicism is it's like, take today captive. Focus on today. Forget about what's happened to you. Don't sit around going, this happened to me. No, let it go.
Yeah.
Today is what you can control. Focus on today. Also, I think
pretty wise.
Pretty helpful advice. Then you come to Seneca, who's probably the next in the line in the chronology. And he's a statesman. So this guy's a politician. So he comes and he writes several things. And he is big on bringing it into like practical application for governance and things like that. He writes on the shortness of life, on anger, on the tranquility of the mind. And one of his quotes that I love, and I think is really helpful, is he says, "We suffer," and I think it's brilliant and true, "we suffer more often in imagination than in reality." And it's like, if you're somebody who struggles with anxiety, that resonates with you, right?
Yeah, that hits right.
Oh, my goodness. Because we sit and we worry about everything that could possibly happen. And, you know, in our imagination, we're going, oh, this person's going to do that, and that's going to impact me, and I'm going to lose this. And everything that we spin in our imagination is worse than what happens almost 99% of the time.
Yeah, we spend so much time game planning the future that never happens that we're like, oh, that was a wasted effort.
Yeah, and so Stoicism comes and says, stop it. Like, why are you doing that? Stop it.
Yeah.
So I think it's helpful. So then we come to the fourth guy that we're going to talk about.
The man.
And this is probably the biggest figure in the history of Stoicism. The most famous, the one that people probably read more than any of the other of the ancient sources. And this is the emperor, Marcus Aurelius, who reigns from 121 to 180 A.D., and he's known as the philosopher king. And if you know the great conversation going back through the Greek philosophers, why is that a big deal? Because Plato comes along, he writes the Republic, and he says the greatest thing that you could hope for in civilization, of all the regimes and everything else, is to have somebody who doesn't want power, but receives it, and has a philosophic mind that contemplates the good, the forms, all that kind of stuff, and then brings it down into application for governing. Well, Marcus Aurelius didn't really want to be emperor, and yet he was, and he was a philosopher king, and he's considered, you know, in history they talk about the five good emperors of Rome, that he'll be the last of them.
Okay.
And he does have some mixed bag. Under him, Christians were persecuted. There was a bout of persecution that broke out. A lot of people say that he didn't order it. It just happened while he was emperor. But his teachings, he wrote the book Meditations, which is his most famous contribution to Stoicism. And so that is what we're going to look at from his perspective, which is a treasure trove of Stoic thoughts.
And most importantly, he's the first emperor and gladiator, right?
He is. Very good.
So for those who aren't a part of the great conversation but watch movies, this is our guy.
Yeah, that's true. And his son is Commodus. So like in the movie,
yeah,
you see Marcus Aurelius. This is totally throwaway, but fictional stuff, you know, in that movie, obviously. But his son Commodus was considered by many to be one of the worst, if not the worst, emperor that Rome ever had. He was just as despicable as the movie makes him out to be. He would go down and fight in the gladiatorial arena against people that were, you know, they had to lose or they were injured to lose. He killed tons of his advisors. Like, this guy was a really bad guy. So in the movie, you have Marcus Aurelius and then his son Commodus is awful. Yes, that is true. But let's jump back to Marcus Aurelius. And I want to kind of paint a picture of who this guy is. So he comes in and he's the philosopher king. And I think probably some of the circumstances that exist in Rome at the time helped to forge him into the Stoic that he was.
Okay.
Rome at this time, the Roman Empire, gets hit by something called the Antonine Plague. Mm. And let me just tell you a little bit about that. Estimates were that it killed 5 to 10 million people. Now, we're talking about way back then.
Not a lot of people.
Second century. There's not a lot of people. You kill 5 to 10 million people. That's amazing. 1 in 10 in the empire's population die. 1 in 10 people. So 10% mortality rate in this plague. In Rome, it said that 2,000 people per day are dying. So now I want you to imagine you're the emperor. This is your reality.
He can't control that for sure.
Can't control it. This is the mood of your empire. Your army, which is currently battling up on the northern front of your empire, is being decimated by disease. You're losing soldiers. You've got to get conscriptions and bring them in. All of your farmers are dying. You have an agricultural crisis on your hand. Like everything about, and the plague lasts for 15 years, and the outbreak goes from 165 to 180, which is when he dies, right? So during his reign, a huge, significant part of his reign is facing this plague. And so what are you faced with every day? Something that's beyond your control.
Yeah, suffering.
Suffering. And so when you're Marcus Aurelius and you're coming and writing in your journal every day as to how you're going to face against something that's outside of your control, something that brings death, something that brings intense suffering, that makes the people around you very unpredictable, you can understand why this guy would fly to stoicism. I can't control any of it, so I'm just going to do what I'm going to do. I'm going to harden myself against suffering. I'm going to press in as if death is not the great enemy that should be feared. And you can see, like, okay, as a response to what's going on around him, that makes sense.
And it's interesting that Meditations is a personal journal. It's a lot like the Book of Psalms with all those writers that you're like, oh, this is just this guy's thoughts. He didn't mean for it to go to us in 2025. It's just like, this is what I'm working through personally and how I'm trying to figure out my crisis.
That's it. And so what it does is the Stoic, and in a weird way, it's odd because it forces you to summon up everything from within, right? Like, you have the power within you. And yet at the same time, there's kind of this humbling element that's, I'm insignificant.
Mm-hmm.
Like, in the ultimate scheme of things, death is going to win. Suffering's going to win. I just need to press into it, do my very best. Virtue is its own reward. And you listen to him say things like this. Alexander and his mule driver were both brought to the same place by death. So the greatest guy of his time and his mule driver.
Who no one knows.
Same end. Death got them both. They were either received into the same generative principle of the universe, which would be like whatever that is, heaven, a spiritual realm, or they were equally dispersed into atoms, reduced to meaninglessness. Like, who is Alexander? He's saying, what is Alexander the Great today? He's the same as his mule driver. No different. This is another one. Soon, you will have forgotten all things, and soon, all things will have forgotten you.
It's depressing, but true.
Right? Like 200 years, people are going to be like, Sam who? Will who? Like
200, give it 20 years.
Yeah, that's true. But I mean, it's true. Like, do you remember the name of your great-great-grandparents?
Never even heard it.
I wouldn't know. Like, I have no idea who they are. Here's another one. When you wake up in the morning, tell yourself, the people I deal with today, I'm imagining him writing this, the people I deal with today will be meddling, ungrateful, arrogant, dishonest, jealous, and surly. Like, just brace for it. Your existence is dealing with people that are unpredictable, gross, they're going to be mean. So the only thing you can control is yourself. And so brace for it.
And imagine him. I mean, he's dealing with a plague. I doubt a lot of people are coming up being like, hey, you're doing a great job. Hey, you know how you're handling this crisis? You're doing really good. 1 out of 10 of us die. You know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, he's dead. But you're doing great. No, people are just coming in like, hey, what are we doing here?
Yeah, the streets have to be absolutely in chaos with the amount of suffering that's going on. Here's another one for you. And I want to ask this question. I'm giving these statements because they're very similar to one of the books of the Bible.
Mm-hmm.
Listen to this one. Children's games, he's giving a list, and he's basically going to say they're all the same. Children's games, random gossip, herds of sheep, flocks, gladiators, wild beasts, soldiers, a bone tossed to pet dogs, a bit of bread in fish ponds, ants carrying crumbs, mice scurrying in fear, puppets jerked by strings, all alike. All of them are the same. Ants, mice, soldiers, gladiators, breadcrumbs. What does that mean? They all go to the same end.
Yeah.
All death. What's the meaning of everything that they're busy working about? So in a sense, what he's saying is, and what he's trying to say, like, I hear that and I go, why bother?
Yeah.
Like, that leads me to despair. But what the Stoic wants you to realize is there's freedom in that. You get what, you know, yeah. Like, hey, you're worried about your life. Chill out. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Death is coming. Suffering's coming. So relax. Do the next right thing. Do the virtuous thing. Because death is coming for us all, and we're no different than scurrying mice. So chill out. I don't take it that way.
Yeah.
Right? But he does. It's, you know, as somebody who doesn't know Christ, who doesn't know God, how else would you have to respond with any measure that makes you wake up the next morning?
Yeah, like, it gets so close to Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he, like, does all of the work. It's like, if you get to Christianity yourself, this would be the way. Like, if you get to all of this without Jesus, without the hope of an afterlife, this is what you would be living for. And it just kind of sad that he misses the main point.
Mm-hmm. So the book that I was talking about, that this is very similar to, like, if Marcus Aurelius had read the book of Ecclesiastes, I would love to watch him respond to it. Because in Ecclesiastes, what's the main message of the book?
Everything's vanity.
Everything's vanity. It's all meaningless. And Marcus Aurelius would have been like, hey, that's what I say. Like, because it comes along and it says, it's the king, you know, Solomon, perhaps, writing the book of Ecclesiastes. But it's a king who's got tremendous amounts of wealth. And what does he say about wealth?
Doesn't matter.
It's meaningless. It didn't fill the hole. Like, eventually I'm going to die and it's all going to be left to somebody else. So what's the purpose of chasing after it? Mm-hmm. All the wisdom, all the books, all the knowledge, everything I've gained in this world, gosh, like, it's meaningless because my reign is going to be replaced by fools. It ends up being worthless and I die anyway. All the relationships, all the wives, all the good, all the fun, all the everything that you could pursue, you could chase down everything in this world, wrestle it to the ground to where you own it, and you've got the most of it. And what do you realize once you've wrestled it down to the ground and you have it?
It's all nothing.
It's meaningless. Yeah. Like, death, the grave is going to swallow it all. And ultimately, like, it doesn't satisfy you anyway. Like, the writer of Ecclesiastes has all this stuff, and he's like I kind of wish I would have never been born. And the reality is, when you look at the people that have the most, that are the wealthiest, when they finally get everything they've ever been striving for, what's typically the response? This didn't satisfy me like I thought it was going to.
Yeah, what's next?
What's next? I need something bigger because the hole in my heart, I think, just grew. Right? So one of the key phrases in the book of Ecclesiastes that makes it so brilliant is it makes all these cases similar to the way Marcus Aurelius makes these cases, but it keeps using a phrase again and again. It'll say, there's nothing new under the sun. Why say that? Why not just say there's nothing new? He adds the phrase under the sun because he presupposes that there is something
above,
beyond, right? So yes, in this world, we see death. Death just keeps winning. Death keeps swallowing. Suffering seems like it's in vain. Everything under the sun is exactly what Marcus Aurelius says. Like, that's what it seems like. But the Bible presupposes that there's something beyond the sun. There's something outside of what we can see and measure and taste and touch and, you know, study. And that's the heavenly realm. And what does Christianity teach? It teaches that Jesus is beyond the sun, but he took on flesh, came down into our existence, and on a key mission. Do you know what he says? If Solomon in Ecclesiastes says, there's nothing new under the sun, here you have Jesus in one of his final words in the New Testament says, behold, I make all things new. The grave doesn't render your life meaningless. All of your suffering wasn't in vain. There is a plan. God is sovereign. He works and moves through all of these tragedies to bring about beautiful results. There's meaning behind them. When you wake up, it's not just like, oh, we're rats running around and there's no purpose to this. No, no, no. Even in the midst of the suffering, God's sovereign hand is weaving about a beautiful design that will bring about something that's worthy of hope, that's worthy of purpose, that has you waking up. And by the way, the grave does not win. So where Stoicism leaves you with this cold, rigid, hopeless, I got to just go through it, and I'm only going to control what I can control, Christianity calls you to say, lean into the God who is sovereign over all things, who will overcome the grave for you, who gives purpose to all of your suffering. And it's like if Marcus Aurelius is like, it's all hopeless, cold, sterile, and gross, and so just deal with it and buck up, Christianity's like, this world's hard, but it has meaning and purpose, and the grave's not going to win over you. So wake up not just with a defiant but meaningless, like, all right, well, I'm going to trudge through this till I die. It's like, no, no, no. You have eternal significance to everything you do right now.
Yeah, it's like Stoicism comes to it and says, there is suffering with like a period.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the beauty of the gospel is it comes, there is suffering, comma, but I'm making all things new.
Yeah, brilliantly said.
Which changes
everything. I mean, we talk about this all the time, which is the purpose of this show, is that, like, that's the beauty of it.
Mm-hmm. And so going on, like, so this is where it's like, man, in terms of practical application, stoicism in this world, there's a lot to mine out of it. So, like, this is one thing that he would say, Marcus Aurelius, if it's not right, don't do it. And if it's not true, don't say it. What would Christianity say to that?
Amen.
100%. Like, I love that. Here's another one that Christianity takes the flavor of. Like, if stoicism comes and says, confine yourself to the present, like we talked about. Stop stewing on yesterday. Just let it go. Put it out of your mind. Force it to be gone. Focus on today and don't worry about tomorrow. Like, don't even think about it. Like, you can't control it. Don't think about it. What would Christianity say to all of that?
I mean, it's Matthew 6. It's like, don't worry about tomorrow. Today has enough trouble on its own.
That's right. But what does it add to that? Like, stoicism says you can't control it. It's probably gonna stink. It's probably gonna be really hard, and you're probably gonna hate it. But, or at least want to hate it. What the Bible does is it says, hey, you know who's in charge of all of your tomorrows?
Yeah, it's different.
It gives you hope. Like, the same God that, you know, clothes the lilies of the field and the flowers and gives the birds what they need to survive, like, that God's got your tomorrow, so stop worrying about it. Let it be his problem. Now I can actually do that. Mm-hmm. Like, oh, if there is a God out there that controls my tomorrows, I can go, okay, I trust him. But if you're telling me don't think about it, it's like, don't think about the 400-pound, you know, gorilla that's right behind you. It's like, that's all I can think about now. And what about your yesterdays? Stoicism says, tough, get over it, it's over, control today, yeah. Confine yourself to today. Does Christianity say forget everything that ever happened to you? What does it say? Acknowledge it,
yeah.
But know that the God of the universe loves you enough that whatever you've done, whatever guilt you've carried, whatever shame you carried, whatever is burdening you from your yesterdays, what should you do with it? Give it to him.
Yeah.
You trust him with it. He wipes it clean. As far as the east is from the west, your sins are removed from you. Let go of your yesterdays in terms of how they shackle you. So Marcus Aurelius is like, just do it. And the Bible comes and says, here's how you can do it. The only way you can do it. I've got your tomorrows. I've got your yesterdays. Now you can live in the present with hope and freedom.
Yeah, Stoicism reminds me of John 15 without Jesus. You know, it's like, abide in me, you know, and I'll produce fruit in you. Mm-hmm. Stoicism feels like I'm just a tree who's like yearning to produce fruit. Like, I'm just trying and struggling my best to do it. Whereas Christianity is the gift that says, no, just be connected to Jesus and that fruit will come.
Yeah. It's from the indwelling power of the Spirit. It's from falling in love with him. It's from seeing his character as the most beautiful thing. You become more like him when you see him as the most beautiful thing. But Stoicism is like, just do good for the sake of doing good. And you're like, but why? If I can get away with doing bad and it helps me or it alleviates my suffering, what is the incentive? What is the innate incentive for me to do good or for humanity to do good?
Mm-hmm.
And you're left going, I don't know, we're all scurrying mice, so mice don't seem to live by those principles. You know, if it's all meaningless, we're just bread on the waters, like, why do good if I can get away with doing bad?
Stoicism doesn't seem to have an earthly upside if you're actually following it. It feels like you're doing all this work, just why?
Yeah, I mean, by confining yourself to today, if you can go la, 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 tomorrow, yesterday, I'm only going to look at, and I know death, and I'm going to feel liberated by the fact that this doesn't continue, but then the question is, why not just kill yourself now? Like, why bother with suffering? Why bother with any of the stuff? Why go through the, I'm going to try to ignore the fact that the world's hard? Like, if there's nothing beyond it, that's what Camus, you know, one of the philosophers says, like, one of the greatest questions we can ask ourselves philosophically every day is, why not kill myself?
Hmm.
Like, that's harsh, and that's kind of like, I'm almost nervous to say it on a program. But it's like, you want to ask Marcus Aurelius the question, like, what do you get out of this?
Yeah.
Why endure through the plague? What hope is there? What are you doing? Like, Christianity comes and complements that, fulfills it, gives it beauty. And so, like, if we're walking through, again, the big cornerstones of Stoicism, moral virtue, we would all say, like, they have the cardinal virtues. Where are they? Wisdom, justice, courage, and temperance. Like, Christianity would come and say yes to all of them.
Yeah.
Do it well. And you're going to fail at it, by the way. And there's forgiveness for that. So don't be enslaved by it. But that should be what you pursue because that's who our God is. The next one, understand that death, adversity, and suffering are natural. Like, the Bible doesn't come and say, nope, you'll never suffer. Just accept Jesus, you'll get the fine life. No, it says you're going to have trials and tribulations. You're going to walk through the hard roads. You're going to walk through the valley of death. But it adds, I will be with you in all of it. It will not have victory over you. I will ultimately defeat the grave and give you purpose to the midst of all that.
Yeah, the Bible comes and says there's a purpose to suffering because suffering leads us to glory. It's not just, hey, suffer for suffering's sake and get through it. It says, no, I'm doing something through it. I'm conforming you more into the pattern of Jesus because we have a Savior who suffered.
Yeah, that's right. And so, I mean, you think about it. The ultimate example of this is the cross. Yeah. Jesus doesn't go to the cross and he's like, well, you know, humanity's just terrible and I'm suffering. And
I don't know why this is happening.
Yeah. It's this suffering is being orchestrated by God to produce something far more beautiful. And when you invest your sufferings in the Lord and you trust your sufferings to the Lord, one, it takes away the misery of thinking this is all in vain, this is all meaningless. Like, that's probably the worst part of suffering is wondering the whys.
Yeah.
But if you can trust God's doing something through him, even if you can't see him, it infuses it with purpose and beauty.
And Jesus is so explicit about it, you know. Take heart, for in this world you will have trouble, but I've overcome the world. He's like, don't wonder about this.
Yeah.
It's doing something.
And so it adds this personal relational dynamic to everything you do in life, rather than the cold, sterile, random, totally uncontrollable thing where it's like, this is just blind, cruel fate. No, everything comes to you under God's eye. And he is going to work it for your good, for his glory. Even the ugly stuff, he's going to turn into his own masterpiece. And to live in the knowledge and peace of that, even when you can't see it or make sense of it, or you have questions about it, adds a layer of peace. And another one, live in accordance with the natural order. Like the Bible comes to us and says, yep, Romans 1. Like the world itself reflects the design of God that you should conform yourself to. Amen. High five, Stoics. Like, we're on the same page there. And daily reflection and self-assessment and writing down your thought, like the Bible comes to you and says, absolutely, you should do that. Mm-hmm. Like, these are all the pillars of Stoicism. And there's so much of it that's commendable. Mm-hmm. So much of it that's commendable. But at the end of the day, if I'm Marcus Aurelius or I'm one of his disciples, like his son, who's got all this stuff, right? And Marcus Aurelius is saying, hey, Commodus, join this kind of life where you set that aside and you live with self-restraint. Not, what does his son do?
None of that.
No chance. If I can, I will, because there's no higher purpose behind it. It's just, you're going to die. There's no meaning to any of it. So be good for goodness sake. Commodus is like, nah, I'm out. Christianity offers, one, a whole system of rewards and punishments for how you live in this world if you're outside of virtue. But beyond that, it gives a pathway of hope and meaning that Commodus wouldn't have had coming from his father with Stoicism.
I think the biggest difference is Stoicism says, it's me on my own. Like, I got to figure this out. Like you said earlier, it's like all this inner turmoil that you're just trying to get it right. Whereas Christianity comes to us and says, no, Jesus said, I will be with you till the end of the age. Mm-hmm. And then he says, hey, here's the Holy Spirit. It's better that I leave so that you can have the helper to help you in this life.
Mm-hmm. And there's another part of this where Stoicism, you know, you talk about the helper. Stoicism says, find it in yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, you've got it. Make it through today. Block everything else, like, and do the right thing. Christianity comes along, and when you're at your weakest, you know, you think of the Apostle Paul, this incredible guy who goes through hellish things for the sake of the gospel, and he's crying out to the Lord, and the Lord responds to him and says, this is 2 Corinthians 12:9, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in your weakness. So Christianity comes and says, hey, when you recognize your own inabilities, when you come and you say, I don't have what it takes to get through this, I feel broken, God comes and says, when you're at that moment, my grace comes into your life and my power now takes over for you. When Paul is saying, I despair of life, I don't know if I can do it again, where does he lean? He doesn't say, buck up, Paul. He says, man, the power of Christ's resurrection working in and through me, even when I despair of life, is why I take another step. Because I know this present suffering is not worthy to be compared with the glory that's going to be revealed. I know that there's purpose to these sufferings, and so when I'm weak, I can borrow hope from the promises of tomorrow that Christ gives me, and I can take another step in his strength because of what he gives me. Not just, I don't know, find a reason. Forget about yesterday. Forget about tomorrow. Just take another step because it's the right thing to do. That would crush me.
Yeah, both Stoicism and Christianity say, hey, there's a hole in your heart. There's something missing. But Stoicism says, you better fix that. Have a good time with that. Which Christianity says, no, you can't fix that. Like, there's someone who had to die. God had to come in order to fix that.
You know, and I think to add on to that, I think one of the things that when you hear the term Stoic, you, what is that? What does it make you always think of? Oh, that person's really Stoic. How do you imagine them?
Like a stone.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
There's no emotion, stiff upper lip, like nothing bothers me. Nothing's going to excite me. Nothing's going to make me laugh. Nothing's going to make me cry.
Like a flat line.
Like I'm untouchable, right? And that's another part where Christianity departs from that, because if you're untouchable, it means you really can't enjoy things. Mm-hmm. If you make yourself entirely invulnerable to what's going on in the world, love can't reach you. Joy can't reach you. Laughter, you become stone. And so Tim Keller, who writes about Stoicism, says this, and I think it's really good, actually. He says, Stoicism says, don't let it get to you. Christianity says, let it get to you, but bring it to God. Right?
Yeah.
So the Bible comes and says, rejoice with those who rejoice. Weep with those who weep. Jesus comes to Lazarus and sees the weeping of everybody who's mourning him as he lays dead in a tomb. And what does Jesus do? Shortest verse in the Bible.
He wept.
Jesus wept. He looks at Jerusalem that is running away from him, running toward eternal destruction. And what does he do? He weeps over Jerusalem. This is God in the flesh. Marcus Aurelius would have looked at that display of emotion and said, that's weakness. And our God comes and says, no, 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 no. To make yourself emotionally available to those around you, to enter into their experience, to show love, knowing ultimately that all this is going to be redeemed. So it's coming with big doses of hope is the greatest thing you can do for your people. There is no greater love than to lay your life down for your friends. We have a great high priest, Hebrews is all about this, who came into this world to do what? To suffer through all the conditions that we suffer, to know what it's like to be betrayed, to know what it's like to weep, to know what it's like to be alone, to know what it's like to be poor, to know what it's like to be homeless, to know what it's like to go through everything, the kind of things that we go through. Why? So that when we're in our tears and we're praying out to God, he's not a stoic God up in heaven going, I do not relate. I am totally without this. I cannot empathize with you. No, we have a great high priest who has suffered in many of the same ways that we do, and he's compassionate as a result. So Christianity, in a sense, looks at the moralist side of Stoicism and says, yes, that's virtuous. That's important. Do it. And then it adds, here's why you can do it and how you can do it. And then it just infuses all of it with beauty. And so Stoicism is left radically incomplete, not only for this life, but the reality is you could try Stoicism as hard as you can, and one day you're going to stand before your maker and he's going to look at you and said, you tried to do it all on your own. You tried to meet the perfections of heaven. You tried to be good enough all on your own. And in that arrogance, you now stand before me and say, I'm worthy of you. With no measure of mercy or grace, and you will be found woefully inadequate. You cannot do it on your own. That is the reason why our God sent his son, to do it on your behalf and to free you from what's called the curse of the law, because you can't measure up to it. You can't measure up to the perfect standards of God, and so God made a way for you, and now you know what he requires of you? To just recognize some of the truths that Stoicism, you're going to die. You can't control things. You can't control your eternal fate. You can't add purpose, and you can't be good enough. So humble up. Recognize you're going to die. Recognize that you're weak. Recognize you can't control these things. And rather than shoving it down and saying, but I'm going to deal with it anyway on my own terms, say, man, there's got to be something outside of me that can rescue me from this body of death. And there is. And his name is Jesus.
Yeah, that's a beautiful call to gospel.
Yeah. So my I have such a heart for the Stoics. Like, I feel like one of them. If I were a Christian, I feel like I would try my hardest to be a Stoic, and I would be miserable at trying to figure it out. Because at the end of the day, I just don't see how it stands.
Yeah.
I don't get the purpose or the reasoning behind the why. Why continue in this? What is the reward? What's the meaning? There isn't one. And even Marcus Aurelius himself says, you just dissolve to atoms. You're no different than the bread on the pond. Yuck. Christ offers a much better picture.
Yeah, I just want to give the Stoics a hug and say, hey, come meet Jesus.
Amen. Amen. So, big hug to the Stoics. Check Jesus out.
Yeah.
So I think we'll leave it there for this episode. So thank you so much for watching. Join us again as we go into another biblical topic.
Don't forget to like and subscribe. We'd love you checked out some other content we have. You can find that at sunlitstudios.com.